Our next presentation looks at the scandal of Candlestick, or Charles Harney's revenge. It looks at the Giants' move from Steel Stadium, where they began after moving from New York in 1958, to Candlestick Park in 1960, and the role Candlestick plays in the Giants moving west. He is a professor of English emeritus at the University of Puget Sound, and he's working on a book on Horace Stoneham and the Giants moved west. From Cookeville, Washington, Robert Garrett.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate Sabre. I'm relatively new to the organization. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and present some work in progress. And I've already talked to a lot of you. Some of you have been, you're veterans of Candlestick. So I'm very grateful to be here, and I look forward to sharing my research with you. Candlestick, the Temple of Wind, Field of Screams, Harney's Horror, Foggy Field, Valley Forge, The Stick. These are just a few of the names of the most vilified baseball stadium of the late 20th century, home for the San Francisco Giants from 1960 until 1999. The 1983 Players Poll found it to be the worst facility to play in. Besides its famous weather, wind, fog, dust storms, bone-chilling cold, the place was utilitarian and soulless, devoid of any comfort and decoration. Location was also a problem, as the park was situated 10 miles from downtown. Getting to and from the place on game days, even with normal attendance, was a chore with freeway entrances, exits, and small side roads. You can get an idea of the downtown way over on the other side of that slide. Indeed, it has been said that the only thing worse than playing baseball in Candlestick was watching baseball there. There were few amenities and less charm. Vince Scully called it a mean park. From the moment the Giants took the field for the first time in 1960, their history was affected by their home playing field in ways that were unparalleled through Major League Baseball during the same period. Hank Greenwald, who suffered the cold winds of Candlestick for 17 years as the radio voice of the Giants, identified the stadium as the essential feature of the Giants' story in San Francisco, both for what happened and especially for what didn't happen. The obvious that he talks about in the last part of this quote. What was terribly obvious about it is that not once, but twice, in their first 35 years in San Francisco, the Giants almost left town, due in large part to the condition at Candlestick Park. I need to go back to this slide. Even after the enclosure of the park in 1971 to accommodate the 49ers, the wind was still a problem and, in fact, was even more unpredictable. Bob Lurie, the man who saved baseball for San Francisco when Horace Stoneham was forced to sell a team in 1976, was obsessed with Candlestick during his tenure as owner. First, he tried to make a silk's purse out of a sow's ear, trying a number of promotions, including hiring daredevil Carl Buenda for a tightrope walk across the windy stadium. Under Lurie's tenure, the Giants introduced the famous quad de Candlestick, given to those hardy souls who sat through extra inning games. I'm delighted to know that in attendance here in this room, there are a number of you who own these fantastic badges. Congratulations. And you know who you are in your caps. Some of your caps show this, and I've been told by others in the audience that you have them at home. Lurie even led by example, taking a front row field box on the first base side, eschewing Horace Stoneham's eyrie in the upper bastion of Candlestick, and sat in night games in his shirt sleeves or in his blazer, impervious to the elements. Then he tried four times to get measures passed at the ballot box for a new stadium, only to have each one go down to defeat, one by the slimmest of margins on a percentage point of one or 1.5. Finally, in 1992, even with some success on the field, especially in the years of the Hum Babies under Al Rosen and Roger Craig, Lurie had enough. He sold the team to new ownership who would endure Candlestick for 8 more years, eventually leaving in 2000 for the majestic new confines of AT&T. Stories about the elements, the wind, the fog, the teeth-rattling temperatures, dancing hot dog wrappers, circling dust clouds, and the effect on both players and fans are the stuff of modern baseball lore and apocrypha. Many of these stories are well known, certainly to an audience like this. The great Mays remarked that you ran the base as a candlestick to stay warm. Felipe Alou remarked that the wind blew so hard toward right field that as an outfielder, he could lean into it and rest. Lon Simmons, longtime voice of the Giants in the early days in San Francisco, recalls a 1961 night game with the Dodgers when Orlando Cepeda hit a towering pop fly that soared above the fog bank that had rolled into the stadium. None of the Dodger fielders could locate the ball until they heard a clump in left center. Meanwhile, Orlando Cepeda ended up on third base. Al Michaels, broadcasting games in the mid-70s, remembers a time when Dodgers infielder Bill Russell's cap was blown off his head and wound up pinned against the left field wall without hitting the ground. Robbie Thompson remarked that when he and Will Karch were rookies in 1986, Bob Brenly, veteran catcher, told them not to be in any hurry with pop flies and candlestick. Don't call for the ball right away. Surround it, and then decide in the last few seconds who will take it. And of course, the quintessential candlestick story, Stu Miller, all of 160 pounds of him, knocked off the mound by a quiet burst of wind in the 1961 All-Star Game, has been told so often, and befitting candlestick fashion, blown out of all proportion, that Miller might be still caught up in the jet stream, floating somewhere over San Francisco Bay. The truth, as we all know, is slightly different. Indeed, when the best thing that can be said about a ballpark is that it didn't fall down during an earthquake, as was the case in 1969 World Series, then you know you are scratching for attributes. 1989, when you're searching for attributes. Now, however entertaining these details are in a notorious way, and Pache Greenfield and his opinions about the effect they had on the Giant record in the first 40 years on the West Coast, they are not my chief concern in looking at the stadium as an essential feature of Giants history. Rather, I am interested in the pre-existence of Candlestick, if you will, as a concept, a token, and a crucial force in the Giants' decision to relocate to San Francisco in 1958, particularly as part of the city's effort in landing the team. Part of my interest involves the location and construction of the stadium. I contend that Candlestick's notoriety began long before the first pitch was thrown on April 12, 1960, that the story of the stadium's planning, financing, and building were something of a scandal in their own right, adding to the colorful history of Major League Baseball in San Francisco. We must remember that the fundamental reason for baseball's great Western migration in 1958 grew first and foremost out of the extreme dissatisfaction with stadiums, the Polo Grounds for the Giants and Ebbets Field for the Dodgers. Since the story of baseball's move, now here we have, of course, Horace Stoneham in the middle and Walter O'Malley talking about a project that involved a dome in New York. We know that the migration of baseball's baseball's move west is told almost exclusively from the Dodgers' point of view. We know a great deal about Walter O'Malley's protracted wrangling with Robert Moses and the city of New York over a suitable home for the Dodgers in Brooklyn. And as the story goes, when O'Malley couldn't get what he wanted for a ballpark or where he wanted it, he moved his Dodgers to California, convincing Horace Stoneham and the Giants to come along with him. But the urgency to move was far greater for Stoneham. Not only were the Giants the poorest drawing ball club in New York City, in 1956, the Giants drew 629,000, half of what the Dodgers drew, and almost a million less than the Yankees. They were also 300,000 lower than any other team in the National League. Some of this was due, no doubt, to the product on the field. They finished sixth in both 1956 and 1957 with almost identical records, 69-87, 26 games out of first place. But there was also the reality of the Polo Grounds themselves. Built in 1911, it was in a terrible state of deterioration. Moreover, there was no parking. Attendance at the Giants' home game was abysmal, except for the Dodger games, when the Brooklynites would come to cheer their team. Over one-third of the Giants' total home attendance resulted from games in which they hosted the Dodgers. O'Malley's arguments about the insufficiency of his home park were largely based on increasing profits. Stoneham's were based on survival. Keeping out of the limelight, holding his cards close to his vest, Stoneham made up his mind to move out of New York City in 1957 early on, announcing his attendance to leave the city, and formally doing so in August, independently, he announced, of what the Dodgers were planning to do. O'Malley did not make his announcements until much later in October, at the season's ends. Stoneham's initial thoughts, as we know, were Minneapolis, who had a good stadium and happened to be the home of the Giants Farm Club. But in the spring of 1957, George Christopher, the mayor of San Francisco, and accompanied by Francis McCarty, chairman of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, made Stoneham an offer he couldn't refuse. A new stadium, the site, and the money for which already were approved by the voters. Stoneham was mad for parking, and Christopher threw in a place for 12,000 cars. This is the site of that parking lot, right outside of Candlestick. And again, because we are familiar with the Dodgers, we know about O'Malley's troubles, and the usual line is that O'Malley faced all his difficulties about his stadium at the very beginning. Horace Stoneham's road to the stadium construction was smooth as could be. It was only after Candlestick was built that Stoneham ran into trouble. But a closer look at the events leading to the building of the Candlestick will show a very different picture, one that suggests tensions, confusion, shenanigans, if not duplicity, underhandedness, and backroom deals with the city hall and the builder. Indeed, Candlestick was trouble from the outset, and the Giants' rush to finish their new stadium 2 years before the Dodgers got theirs produced cost overrides, corner courting that would play out in the stadium's construction, and in political squabbling among the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and the contractor, and that would lead to a grand jury report and a libel suit. When Christopher met with Stoneham in New York in 1957, the mayor was in an enviable and secure position of offering something tangible to the Giants. In 1954, under Mayor Robinson, Christopher's predecessor, San Francisco voters had passed a bond issue for $5 million for the single purpose of building a Major League Baseball park and attracting a team to San Francisco. Stoneham was extremely interested and, in fact, ecstatic about the parking lot. But nonetheless, he said to Christopher that no serious team would want to come unless the figure were much higher than $5 million. Christopher was a little taken back by this pronouncement, but nonetheless determined to land the Giants. Returned home, secure additional funding. Stoneham said, you're going to need at least $14 million. $5 million won't do it. Now, adding to this concern was Christopher's notion as mayor that the bond that was passed in 1954 had strings attached to it. If they did not attract a major league franchise within 5 years, that bond would go away. There was no money guaranteed after 5 years. One thing he didn't have to worry about, however, was the location of the park. The city had already purchased the land from multimillionaire contractor Charles Harney, who agreed to sell it only if he were awarded the contract to build it. Harney was quite the figure around town, successful construction mogul, pillar of the church, benefactor to the University of San Francisco, and an astute real estate wheeler dealer. In 1953, this boggles the mind, he purchased 41 acres of seemingly worthless tide flats from the city at a place called Candlestick Point for $2,000 an acre. In 1957, he sold the same parcel back to the city for $65,000 an acre, a tidy profit. Now, the story of that is, that's a sidebar for this. There's not enough time today to deal with that, but that in itself is amazing. The acquisition of this land was essential to the building of the park, since there were very few places in San Francisco where we could have parking, and seemed to fit the city plans very well, as they already owned 33 contiguous acres. Once the sale with Harney was complete, his condition that he be made contractor to build the city agreed upon, Christopher informed Stoneham in New York that significant progress had been made. Now, as a shrewd politician, Christopher sensed that it would be impossible or absolutely improbable that voters would approve the additional funds to build a stadium. So in the fall of 1957, he and those involved building and planning a stadium founded an organization called the San Francisco Stadium Incorporated, a nonprofit corporation and a shadow organization of City Hall, whose initial officers and directors were none other than Mr. Charles Harney and two of his senior employees from the construction company. The sole purpose of this organization was to issue a bond for additional $6 million and to assign contracts for planning, grading, filling, constructions, matters that under city charter would require a vote of approval and open bidding. Now, with this venture company, shadow company, there were no such restrictions. Thus, although the design, matters of funding, and construction of the stadium were technically subject to the city's oversight and therefore transparent to the public, business was actually channeled through SF Stadium Incorporated, thereby completely ignoring public scrutiny. The legal ruse was necessary, reasoned Christopher and his cronies, to ensure the funding and, more important, the completion of the ballpark in a timely manner. With the funding mechanism in place, Christopher was able to alleviate Stoneham's concern about the costs, and in October of 1957, the Giants signed a letter of agreement with the city of San Francisco. Eventually, even Christopher had qualms about Harney's role in the shadow firm and replaced him with his employees in February of 58. Even with this ploy, the construction of the ballpark continued to have problems. Cost overrides were somehow omitted from the initial design and planning stage and never made it to the contractor's budget. Installation of fire equipment, safety features, landscaping, lighting, waterproofing, irrigation, all had been left out, as was cost for additional engineering, legal fees, and design. Outside the building itself, Stoneham's coveted parking lot needed special ingress and egress construction that had been overlooked. All of these necessities pushed Candlestick's cost to over $14 million. Stoneham, however, was removed from all these mundane budgetary machinations, happily ensconced in Modest Seal Stadium, where despite its 22,200 capacity, the Giants would draw $1,300,000 in 1958. Meanwhile, a campaign was underway to name the stadium Harney Field, initiated by the contractor himself and supported by the mayor. But a citywide survey settled on the name Candlestick Park after its historic location. Harney took the results as a public slight and seemed to lose his enthusiasm for the project. He began a work slowdown, which delayed the park opening by a year. Harney also became punctilious with the details of his contract and demanded extra money for anything that was not listed in the original. Most of the extras, including almost all of the amenities, had to be subcontracted with other firms or scrapped altogether. The final cost to the city was $15,122,700. As the snafus and delays in construction became the subject of newspaper articles and reports, Harney's recalcitrance as a matter of public record, some citizens called for the city's grand jury to look into the problems with Candlestick. The 18-member jury, under the direction of its foreman Henry E. North, a prominent Republican member of the San Francisco business community, began its investigation in the summer of 1958. 6 months later, in December, it released a report that found a number of irregularities, questionable land dealings concerning the fundings and costs to the taxpayers. The reception of the report was cool. The local press, led by Curly Grieve of the San Francisco Examiner, one of the original drum beaters for the Giants coming west, and by the way, also named, the press box is named a Curly Greeb press box, so he has an insight, characterize it as an example of North's grandstanding and public posturing. I'm almost finished. Christopher called North a civic nuisance, labeling the report a private vendetta against progress. He also threw in for a good measure a few personal barbs that North was unreliable, a drinker, and fixable. Observations that prompted North to file a libel suit against the mayor. The suit was eventually dropped. North's grand jury report was swept under the carpet. Henry North died in 1961. Charles Harney died of a heart attack in 1962. The Giants opened in Candlestick in April of 1960, and for the next 40 seasons called the place home. The initial success in the early years in San Francisco gradually faded to decades of frustration and what-ifs. The storied franchise in New York that had won 15 National League pennants and 5 World Championships had, during their tenure at Candlestick, won only 2 pennants. There were no World Championships. Whenever teams go through things like this, long periods of drought, baseball has a simple explanation, a curse. So for those of you seeking to understand the Giants' disappointments at Candlestick Park, I give you the obvious. It is the curse of Charles Harney.
Are there any questions for Robert? Please. We'll start on the right side, in the back.
Right here,
in the blue.
In Robert Caro's biography of Robert Moses, and in biographies of Willard Romano, Stone is generally portrayed as an amiable warrior. Did your research support that?
No. Stoneham was a very clever guy, a better businessman than a lot of people were. He was also, in my opinion and the opinion of some others who have looked into this, a neglected pioneer in baseball. I think Horace Stoneham that's a whole other topic, and Horace Stoneham needs to get a lot more credit for what he did to baseball. So I would disagree completely with that. I think Horace Stoneham was a clever person. He absolutely loved the fact that O'Malley was always in the front. He preferred to stand in the back, but he always made up his mind to do things, and he did them. But that's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because that's a whole other topic.
Do I right here. Mention the final clause against
the park.
How did that compare to Dodger Stadium?
Actually, there are a lot of people in this room who know more about the Dodger Stadium finances than me, but I think, is Andy here? He told you told me last night what the cost of Dodger Stadium was.
$17 million.
17. And the other thing I want to say is that sounds like this is, sort of pennies today. But I think what you have to remember is you have to go back to 1959, 58, remember what a tank of gas was, for example, and go back to the money that you were talking about here. It's pretty serious money. It's not just penny pinching, but it sounds like it's nothing. But in fact, in those days, it was quite a bit. Please.
Did the Giants inspect the site before they committed to it? Did they go there at different times of the day?
There was no helicopter tour of Chavezer being here. They took Stoneham out in the morning, as Christopher did, about 10:30 on a beautiful sunny day. He said, "This looks great. Where's the parking?" He showed him that all this will be filled in. He says, "Great. What time is lunch?" Now, when the construction began, and then it was underway, Chuck Feeney went out later at about 1:30, and he saw things that he was horrified by. Outhouses were being turned over by wind. There was stuff going all in the air, and he says, "Good God, does the wind always blow like this?" And the construction worker says, "Nah, not really. Only between 1 and 5 every day." You wonder why somebody wasn't, watching the store. Yeah.
We'll go in front.
Sorry, you're in charge.
We'll go in front.
I was at a game in 1975 at Candlestick, and the announced attendance was 1,520. Do you know what the smallest crowd in the district?
789, I believe. It was under 1,000. There's a great, Herb Cain.
Yes.
Okay, there's a great Herb Cain column in which he says, "Yeah, I was out at Candlestick the other day. There was Howard Schwartz down the right field. There was so-and-so. There was Willie Brown behind home plate. There was somebody on third base. There was another." He says, "The team? No, those were fans." No, he
got in the 70s, it really went down.
Yeah. Last question.
There was a report about the 1958 Giants that was written in the 1980s in which the author talked to basically what ended up with the team. And one thing that comes across in that book was that a lot of the players were particularly a lot of affection for Steel Stadium. And there was some talk about maybe double decking Steel Stadium. Was that any kind of viable option? Or was there any other viable option as far as the site? Well, besides getting the city.
I don't think I had the time to necessarily stress the pressure that Christopher felt when Stoneman told him about those figures. He was afraid he might lose the Giants. The other thing to remember is Stoneman insisted on parking. The problem was 16th and Bryant. And by the way, Lefty O'Doul was one of the great proponents of double-decking because Steel Stadium was the jewel of minor league baseball all over the country. It was a fantastic place. And if they could just stack in front of the ideal, if there was no parking. And the businessmen wanted the parking, so and they wanted Stone, and so that's how that got kind of played out.
Thank you, Robert, and I'm sure that you.